evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. The sole focus of tonight's KBC Arts is music and conversation with Arlo Guthrie. On Friday, October 23rd, Guthrie announced via his website and Facebook page that he was retiring from performance, effective immediately. He suffered two strokes in recent years and has cited health as a concern. With that said, we're going back to my conversation with Guthrie from a number of years ago when he was about to perform in Riverside. During this first part of the program, we'll touch on a couple of favorite songs, the Motorcycle Song, or Motorcycle, Steve Goodman's City of New Orleans, and, of course, Alice's Restaurant.
This song's called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
Hello.
Arlo Guthrie.
That's me.
I want to thank you ahead of time for telling stories you've told a thousand times, but then again, you do this for a living, I suppose, offstage and on.
It goes with the turf.
Excellent. Well, this is news to me. I saw that in 1991, you purchased the church described in Alice's Restaurant, and now most people, through the song, know this as a place where a lot of garbage had to be hauled out. And now, I know the place has had a few owners since Alice and Ray back in 65, but I'd like for you to talk about the Guthrie Foundation in a moment, but first now, if someone were to visit this building today, Trinity Church, what would they see or experience? A concert venue? I saw that there's even Arlo Guthrie's historic garbage trail walk and an annual free Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat?
Well, it depends on what day you come. There are scheduled events that go on at the church throughout the year. A lot of the church is unusable at different seasons because there's no heat still in the main body. So a lot of the things that go on throughout the year are things that can happen in the small spaces that we have. And most of that is taken up by weekly food programs, you know, where we have free dinner for anybody who wants to come in. And we share that with other churches and other, you know, temples and synagogues, whatever, in the neighborhood, so that on any given day, there's a place to go for somebody to get something to eat. So one of those days is ours. It happens to be Wednesday. If you come during the garbage trail walk, which is a fundraiser for Huntington's disease research and care and all of that, you'll see a few hundred people walking up the street, the same street that we took the garbage out on back in Thanksgiving of 1965. And so we have an annual walk that follows the route. And people are met along the way with free ice cream and shrimp cocktails and all kinds of crazy stuff, and it's lovely. And it ends at the jail where the current chief, Rick Wilcox, who is a dear friend, will pose with pictures behind the original cell door that they still have. You know, so a lot of the stuff that's going on is hinged upon the building's relationship with me and my adventures. But it also goes farther than that and tries to be of some kind of community service to the regular good stuff we were doing back in the 60s.
It's described on the website as a non-denominational organization, but from your description, I would almost say that it's more like a multi-denominational.
It's an interfaith church foundation.
Okay.
And so what that means is that everybody's welcome. If you have a faith, that's great. If you don't, you don't need one to get in. And, you know, whatever differences there are can be left at the door, and you can pick them up on the way out. And a lot of the things that we do that are related to those kinds of matters are, you know, of interest to small groups of people. We're not trying to change the entire world by forming a large organization with a big staff and a big crew. We keep it local for the neighbors and friends who visit from around the world. I mean, it's local in the sense that we're not trying to be a big outfit.
All right.
It was my friend Pete Seeger that told me years ago that he didn't think that there was much hope for a lot of the big organizations that were trying to do things, because they can be thwarted at every move by people who have more money than God and more influence than they should. But there's no way that anybody can stop the millions of little organizations that do things in their own little towns. That nobody has the resources to do that. And so we set out back years ago to create one more space, one more place on the map where people who share the same kind of heart and feeling and spirit can just get together and do things.
Now this is, in essence, looks like the what, when, and why for the Guthrie Foundation. You've written, my gosh, so many songs over the years. I keep on wanting to say over the past 20 years or so, but once I look at the calendar, over the years, you've told so many stories, but often it comes back to Alice's Restaurant, so many people's favorites. Do you ever feel like some of your other great songs or stories might have been just passed over? And I'm curious, what are some that people ought to know about, you think, that have been passed over?
Well, you know, there's two versions of every person that has a relationship with the public. And there's a public version, and there's the regular, everyday you version.
Mm-hmm.
And in public, the way I deal with Alice's Restaurant is to do it every 10 years on its occasional 10th anniversary. So the next time I actually have to learn it will be 2015. That'll be the 50th year that the garbage incident took place. And we'll do it for a couple of years on the road at that time.
Sure.
That was my only way of avoiding the Groundhog Day half-hour movie every night of my life.
Yeah.
And so we just do the ones that we think are either more important or more interesting or more relevant, or the ones that I just happen to like more. And we'll do those for the other 8 out of 10 years on the road. And, you know, in private, in my private life, it doesn't really, it's almost like that's another person.
Okay.
It's so long ago. When you it's like thinking of yourself as a kid. You can have fond memories. You have pictures of it. You have people who remember what you did, something silly or something like that. But that's not you anymore.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't want a pickle. Just want to ride my motorcycle. And I don't want a tickle. I'd rather ride my motorcycle. And I don't want to die. Just want to ride my motorcycle. I've been singing this song, you know, for about 4 years. And I was telling stories about how I wrote it and stuff like that, but there was always one thing about this song. There was always one thing about this song that nobody ever understood, and that was the significance of the pickle.
Two other song-related questions for you. Alice's Restaurant, that's a story that you can follow along. I know there's some fictitious elements to it, but you can see the events you described as actually happening. Now, let's jump over to another well-known one of yours, the pickle and the motorcycle. Now, not so much a story that you can actually believe happened. Tell me, how did this one come about, please? The writing of it.
Well, there's more versions of the pickle song than there is of Alice's Restaurant. And there's a lot of versions of Alice's Restaurant, by the way, some of which are out there. And we've released them over the years. But the pickle thing started back years ago when my friends Alice and Ray Brock, the same people that owned the church, the same Alice that was going to open the restaurant, were interested in motorcycle racing, and we used to go to some of the dirt track events in the area, and we all rode, you know, little, you know, 400 Triumphs or 500 Triumphs in those days, and we got a big kick out of it.
We went off a mountain cliff 500 feet in the air. We were doing 150 miles an hour sideways and 500 feet down at the same time, looking for the fuzz. We knew it was illegal, you know.
And one time I had a relatively interesting accident experience kind of thing, you know, where I went flying through the air, and I might have embellished it a little over the years, and it turned into a version of the motorcycle song that then morphed into other adventures and other songs or other versions of the same song, and we're still doing that on the road at times.
Even with the cop throwing the thing up in the air and then shooting it.
Well, like you say, some things can be, you know, added later on if they're of social significance.
Right.
I don't want a pickle. Just want to ride my Just wanna ride my motorcycle. And I don't want a tickle. I'd rather ride my motorcycle. Just wanna ride on my motorcycle.
Riding on the city of New Orleans.
Another one, if you wouldn't mind telling me about. I'm sure there's a favorite that people often want to hear you do, and that is the city of New Orleans. Now, I feel like not enough people know Steve Goodman's name. Now, I've heard this story, but I would love to get on tape you telling the story of when he came up to you and the story of the beer that was involved in this, if that's even true.
Yeah, this was 1970 or 71, somewhere back in those days. And I was playing a club in Chicago called The Quiet Night. And in those days, you know, we would not do like a one-night show like what we do these days. We were there for like 2 weeks at a time. We'd play these little clubs. And we would do two or three shows a night, depending on where it was. So I wasn't getting out of that club until like, you know, two or three in the morning. And after a show one night, the crowd had left. I'm packing up my instruments and I'm walking out. And this little guy gets in my way. He says, "Arlo, I got to sing you a song." And I just looked at him. I said, "Come on, man, I don't want to hear any songs. I've been singing freaking songs all night. I don't even like my songs. Why should I be listening to your songs?" And he had this look about him that he just, you know, said, "Well, listen, I just want to sing you one song." And I said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. Buy me a beer and I'll sit here and drink it. And as long as it lasts, you can do whatever you want." He says, "That sounds like a good deal." So I look at him. I says, "It does." And he sat down and bought me a beer, and I sat there and listened to City of New Orleans, and I became friends with Steve Goodman that night, and that became one of the best beers I ever had.
A huge, huge tune for you, too. And he ended up, I guess, releasing it maybe the next year or something.
There were different people that released it over the years. I mean, John Denver, you know, did a version of it. Willie Nelson had another hit with it, very rare for one song, back decades after mine. And, you know, it's become a standard song in some folk circles. I mean, Judy Collins recorded it, all kinds of other people over the years. And unfortunately, we lost Goodman back a long time ago now. He was fighting, you know, leukemia, but he's left a great legacy. It's not just City of New Orleans, and that may not even be one of his best songs. That's just one of the good ones.
Oh, yeah.
And he had friends, you know, even closer than me, guys like John Prine and others, who really were legendary characters in their days, is all you can say.
Yeah. Now, some folks out there have been able to catch your shows now for some 40 years. This is going to be a difficult thing because you're looking back at yourself, but can you describe the evolution, or intelligent design, if you will, of Arlo Live? Or is it still pretty much a few people, a few guitars, some stories, some songs? Your son joins in on stage nowadays. What's different from the early days and, you know, how it's progressed over the years?
Well, you know what? If you did anything for 40 years or 50 years, in my case, I did my first show in front of people in 1961. It was in a little place called Gertie's Folk City. It was in February. And so I have passed the 50-year mark at this point. And I can tell you this, that no matter what it is you do, if you do the same freaking thing for 50 years, you will get better at it. Even if you don't want to, even if you don't mean to, even if you have no idea or plan or whatever, you will just naturally have to get better at it. And I think that I've done that. I haven't meant to, you know, although I've enjoyed learning how to play the guitar, and I still am learning a lot, you know, learning how to be a performer. I've worked with some of the most entrancing people on the planet. Guys like Pete Seeger who walk out on stage and the atmosphere changes. There are not many of those. And you learn a lot. I worked with Pete for over 30 years. You learn from people, and you learn from experience, and you learn from the audiences that you play for. And so I think the shows are better than ever. There may be people that like different parts of them, or some years ago, or, you know, they might like a particular version of me in my own evolution. But I am enjoying the current one.
Way cool.
I'm the train that calls.
the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
David Fleming in conversation with Arlo Guthrie. Guthrie just announced his retirement from performance, citing health as a concern. More with Arlo Guthrie just ahead. We spoke a bit about politics. That's something I really never ask about, but it led to some really cool thoughts from Guthrie, and we'll be going back to Alice's Restaurant later in the program. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
I'd mentioned when speaking to Caitlin, I'd mentioned that I think that there's a world of difference between public radio, NPR stuff, and commercial radio, and I wanted her to make sure that you knew that I was calling from a public radio station, hoping that this would make a difference, and she said it often might. Now, you are at the right age to have been aware of public radio and the birth of NPR up to today, and whether you're an everyday listener or just I'm curious of your thoughts on public radio and the philosophy and models behind public radio and NPR and
well,
perhaps
I can tell
even
you this,
versus.
There's a lot of controversy going on right now on both sides of the political spectrum that have to do with the viability of public radio, public television, and frankly, public everything. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people that want to privatize everything, and that would mean they're in favor of private armies and private schools and private highways and private playgrounds and private everything. I'm not one of those. I think there is a place for people to pool their resources and create playgrounds for everybody, streets and sidewalks for everybody, police and firemen for everybody, all of those kinds of things. And I think that's a battle that we're in right now. And one of the parts of that battle has to do with information and how do people understand what's going on and where do they get their information from. I would rather get it from a public source, in other words, funded by the community, than funded by a major multinational corporation. That's just the way it is. Even the network TVs that are battling sort of left and right and stuff like that, there's things that interest me that I don't hear on any of them, because they are in part paid for by people with vested interests. So when you want to talk about, for example, whether or not getting your flu shot is a good idea, you're not going to hear anything bad about it on any network, whether it's cable, whether it's whatever it is, because the pharmaceutical companies that advertise on there is such a large source of revenue, you're not going to hear anything bad about it at all. I hope that that's just one indication, one, for instance, of something important that needs to be aired or needs to be heard for people that are interested. There's all kinds of other stuff that's going on. The food that we eat, the water that we drink, the things that we share in common anyway. Information is one of those things. Culture is one of those things. It's great to travel around the country and hear different kinds of music on the programs that National Public Radio provides, especially in towns that don't have any radio or any TV or any local anything. The local stuff all has gone away. There are still remnants of local TV, but they don't show you anything local hardly anymore, except for maybe a half hour in the evening. I liked the local stuff. I enjoyed it. I liked knowing what my guys were doing, what's happening in my town. And so when there was an emergency or something like that, you could turn on the TV and you would know what's going on right away. Now you have to search through the channels and wait for them to come around to telling your part of the story. That, to me, is a wrong sort of turn in the course of history. And I think we need more local stuff. And frankly, I wouldn't care if it was public or not. I think we need more local private stuff and more local public stuff. I think combined, it might make the kind of difference I'm talking about.
Yeah, in the public radio spectrum, it's one of the things that I still love about it is the fact that it gives you what you cannot get on the rest of the dial. So it's always been a great resource for me, and people have described it to me once they find out.
There are more important things than whether something attracts a large audience. There are important things that, like roads, you know, and highways, and fire, and safety, and food inspectors, and all kinds of stuff that we all chip in for. And I think information ought to be one of those things. If you don't want to watch it or listen to it, that's fine. You got a lot of options. But it's good to have a source like that, and whatever problems it may have, it doesn't have the same economic pressure to sell you something or to not tell you something that a lot of other kinds of radios and TVs have problems with these days.
Absolutely. Your recent 4-day stay in Milwaukee, I was reading you're talking about this at Arlo.net. Was this directly related to the recent political events going on in Wisconsin, or did you have a gig going on there anyway?
I had a gig going on. It was a 3-day run with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. It was a really wonderful few days. And unfortunately, it was a couple of days after I left that this all started. So I was there, but nothing was going on. Nobody was in the streets. Nobody was talking about anything. But I am planning to go up there at some point and, you know, lend a hand and lend a voice to those folks who are out there. I'm a big supporter of people that want to get together and form collective bargaining units that, you know, people that go and speak up for you and speak up for everybody that signed on. I think that's a good idea. I think that is an American institution. There is no question in my mind that unions in general is an American institution. It doesn't come from overseas. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It comes from here. As a matter of fact, the Constitution of the United States, when you read the first part of it, before it gets into all the therefores and whys and the laws and the regulations, the very first thing it says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
Unions.
It starts with those words. In other words, America is a union. It's the very first reason that they mention for having a country in the first place. You can't be anti-union and pro-America at the same time. So all this talk about anti-unionism is anti-Americanism. There's just no question about it. There's no way to rewrite the preamble.
I can't help but speculate, and I know that this is an area that I don't have the right to speculate on, but I can't help but feel if your dad were still alive, he would quite possibly be in Madison, Wisconsin right now with
the people. Of course he would be, and he would have been camping out there and doing all those things and events that are rallying people around the country, and that's what we've been doing, sort of, you know, letting people know that those folks up there need support and they need help, and that if no one helps them, there won't be anybody to help you when you're in trouble that way. And we got, you know, and there were people on my website that complained and said, well, I always had troubles with the unions and blah, 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 and I don't like them, and they don't do anything for me. And I just reminded them, I said, look, you know, whatever you're working for, the peanuts that you're getting these days, somebody somewhere had the courage to join up with the union and demand that wages be what they are. Your wages today are based on a market in which the unions play the negotiating part, whether you're working with them or not. That's why we have weekends. That's why we don't have kids working in factories anymore. That's why there's safety rules and regulations. Have some of these places and unions gone overboard and asked for too much? Sure. But that doesn't negate what the importance is for having them in the first place, or the right to have them. And that's what these people are fighting for up there, and I'm with them.
That's beautiful. One other thing here, and this is maybe a complicated issue, and I read that you're a registered Republican, and
yeah.
There was a note that I had maybe read in the same thought or whatever, that you had said that we've had some good Democrats, we need some good Republicans. Now, people would assume, I hate to say, but people would assume that you'd be a Democrat or something even, gosh, further left for, you know, the...
Well, I think the real fight right now is fairly obvious.
Uh-huh.
It's not left or right. That's all smoke and mirrors. The real fight going on is between people with a whole lot of money and people that are losing everything. It's the big companies and the big corporations against the regular guy. That's how I see it. And that fight is going on in the Republican Party as much as anywhere else. You see this big divide going on in the Congress right now, in the House, between people who want to, like I said, abandon every opportunity to be working together on things, and people that know that we have some responsibility to work on things. I think that's where the interesting fight is. And so I thought, let's get into it. Let's get into that fight. Let's talk about these things. And the only way they get you in is if you sign up, and it's like getting in the library. You can't take out a book without a card. So I figured, okay, let's do that. I wasn't worried about the Democrats. They got enough of those guys, especially where I was from in Massachusetts. I mean, there's enough good Democrats up there. What we need is a few more good Republicans.
Yeah,
otherwise, it becomes one-handed, and I don't like any country that gets taken down that path. I think it's dangerous. I don't think it's a good idea. And frankly, I'm thinking of going back because there's a lot of fighting that needs to happen within the Democratic Party. I don't think the administration has handled everything in the right way either. So I'm ticked off with everybody. I just think that we're seeing a whole lot of advertising and a whole lot of money and a whole lot of sophisticated attempts to sideswipe the issues that are really important and put instead things that really don't mean a whole hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, people are duped into talking about one thing or another when something else is going on. It's like this global climate change. It's like two people sitting in a canyon and a rock is falling on them from up on a cliff. And they're sitting there arguing about, well, it was pushed by God. And the other guy said, no, man pushed that rock. And the other one said, no, that was pushed by nature. And the other one says, no, it was man. Neither of them is getting out of the way. That's the big issue. Get out of the way first and then figure out, you know, if you want. If it's still important after it's fallen and you got out of the way and you're safe, you can sit there and argue about it if you want. But to get caught up in an argument of who did it first, of why it's happening, without doing something about it, to me is just stupid.
Absolutely. You had a really wonderful analogy there with the rock falling and not moving out of the way thing. That, I mean, that is just really quite wonderful, and I'll probably adapt that myself for some models in the future.
Well, I think, you know, those are the kind of things that I think people just have to get real. And there's so few opportunities for them to do so without ticking off somebody, without crossing somebody who is either paying for your TV show, paying for your radio show, in some way involved. These guys got their fingers in everything. I think the bad guys, and maybe some of the good guys, have got their fingers in the judges, in the courts, in the elections, in the houses of Congress, in the administration, in the White House, in all of it. And it's going to take a hell of a lot of work to get us out of this mess. And the only way to do it is through talking to each other and having conversations that are, you know, where you don't have to be right all the time, but you ought to be thinking about stuff.
At least conversations.
And it's happening. You know, it's actually happening. It can be done. I remember there was this big controversy about whether or not milk in stores, whether it was healthy to have that bovine growth hormone stuff that they were putting in the cows that got in the milk. There was people talking about it. It was on the internet. It never came before a vote in Congress. The president never talked about it. There was no court decisions about it. But when enough people said, I don't want to buy it anymore, Walmart pulled it off the shelf. That's how you get things done. You talk to your friends and neighbors, you get things going, you get the information out there. Sometime you might be right, sometime you might be wrong, but you do it anyway. And when you do that, you affect the course of history and you affect the feeling of empowerment that people have that they can actually do something and you can get something done. You don't have to wait for your politician. You don't have to wait for your local corporation or whatever, or your school district or whatever. You don't have to wait. You can do stuff now.
In essence, that's collective bargaining outside of the workplace.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. It's been conversation with Arlo Guthrie for the first part of the show, and now when Guthrie and I were speaking about Alice's Restaurant earlier in the program, it may have caused some distress when I faded out Alice's Restaurant and started the motorcycle song, or the motorcycle song, if you will. So to round out the program, back to Alice's Restaurant, the original 1967 recording in its entirety.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago. It was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant. She lives in the church nearby the restaurant in the bell tower with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile is better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obie, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking to Obie for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obie could have done at the police station, and the first was that he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely, and we didn't expect it. Another thing was that he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't even counted upon, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, "Obie, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." And that's what we did, and sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this happened. Here they got three stop signs, two police officers and one police car, but when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in the newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster, tire track, footprints, dog smelling prints, and they took 27 8x10 color glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, the southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. After the ordeal, we went back to the jail. Obie said he was gonna put us in the cell. Said, "Kid, I'm gonna put you in the cell. I want your wallet and your belt." And I said, "Obie, I can understand you wanting my wallet so I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for?" And it said, "Kid, we don't want any hangings." Said, "Obie, did you think I was gonna hang myself for littering?" Obie said he was making sure, and friends, Obie was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and drown. And he took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll out to roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll and have an escape. Obie was making sure, and it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice, remember Alice? It's a song about Alice. Alice came by and with a few nasty words to Obie on the side, bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, and didn't get up until the next morning when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obie came in with a 27 8x10, covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back each one. Sat down. Man came in, said, all rise. We all stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures. And the judge walked in, sat down with the C&I dog, and he sat down. We sat down. Obie looked at the C&I dog. Then the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the C&I dog. And then the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and began to cry, cause Obie came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice and there wasn't nothing he could do about it. And the judge wasn't gonna look at the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft. You got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in and you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went down to get my physical examination one day, and I walked in, I sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning. Cause I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. Man, I wanted to feel like the, I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York. And I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, they gave me a piece of paper, said, kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. And I went up there, I said, shrink, I want to kill. And I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead burnt bodies. I mean kill. And I started jumping up and down, yelling kill. And it started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling kill. And the sergeant came over, pinned the medal on me, sent me down the hall, said, you're our boy. Didn't feel too good about it. Proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, detections, neglections, and all kinds of stuff that they was doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, and I just having a tough time there. And they was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they was leaving no part untouched. Proceeded through, and I went, finally came to see the very last man. I walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, what do you want? He said, kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested? And I proceeded to tell him the story of Alice's restaurant, Massacre, with full orchestration and five-part harmony and stuff like that. And then all the phenomena stopped me right there and said, kid, did you ever go to court? And I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and stopped me right there and said, kid, I want you to go over and sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid! And I walked over to the bench there, and there's is Group W is where they put you. If you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime, and here was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench there. Mother rapers. Father stabbers. Father rapers. Father rapers sitting right there on the bench next to me, and one, he was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting guys are sitting there on the bench. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me, and he was mean and ugly and nasty and horrible and all kinds of things. And he sat down next to me and said, "Kid, what'd you get?" I said, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage." He said, "What were you arrested for, kid?" And I said, "Littering." And they all moved away from me on the bench there to carry eyeballing all kinds of mean, nasty things till I said, "And creating a nuisance." And they all came back, shook my hand, and we had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, all kinds of groovy things that we was talking about on the bench. And everything was fine. We were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things until the sergeant came over, had some paper in his hand, held it up and said, "Kids, this piece of paper's got 47 words, 37 cents, it's 58 words. We want to know details of the crime, time, crime, and else kind of thing. Got to say, pretend to about the crime, want to know the arresting officer's name, and else kind of thing. You got to say, and talk for 45 minutes, and nobody understood a word that he said. But we had fun filling out the forms and playing with the pencils on the bench there. And I filled out the massacre with the four-part harmony and wrote it down there just like it was, and everything was fine. And I put down a pencil and I turned over the piece of paper, and there on the other side, in the middle of the other side, away from everything else on the other side, in parentheses, capital letters, quotated, read the following words: "Kid, you rehabilitated yourself." I went over to the sergeant and said, "Sergeant, you've got a lot of damn gall to ask me if I've rehabilitated myself. I'm sitting here on a bench. I mean, I'm sitting here on the Group W bench because you want to know if I'm moral enough to join the army, burn women, kids, houses, and villages after being a litter bug." He looked at me and said, "Kid, you don't like your kind. And we're going to send your fingerprints off to Washington, and friends, somewhere in Washington, enshrined in some little folders, and study in black and white of my fingerprints. And the only reason I'm singing you the song now is because you may know somebody in a similar situation. Or you may be in a similar situation. And if you're in a situation like that, there's only one thing you can do, is walk into the shrink wherever you are. Just walk in and say, 'Shrink, you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant,' and walk out. You know, if one person, just one person does it, they may think he's really sick and they won't take him. And if two people do it in harmony, they think they're both faggots and it won't take either of them. And if three people do it, can you imagine three people walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out? They may think it's an organization. And can you imagine 50 people a day? I said 50 people a day walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out. And friends, they may think it's a movement. and that's what it is. The Alice's Restaurant, anti-massacre movement, and all you gotta do to join is to sing it the next time it comes around on the guitar with feeling. So we'll wait till it comes around on the guitar here. Sing it when it does. Here it comes. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. That was horrible. You want to end war and stuff, you gotta sing loud. You could put a lot. I've been singing the song now for 25 minutes. I could sing it for another 25 minutes. I'm not proud. Or tired. So we'll wait till it comes around again. And this time with four-part harmony in the feeling. We're just waiting for it to come around is what we're doing. All right now. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Excepting Alice. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. So walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. At Alice's Restaurant.
Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant to round out this edition of KVC Arts and conversation with Guthrie for the first two-thirds of the show. Once again, on Friday, October 23rd, Guthrie announced via his website and his Facebook page that he was retiring from performance effective immediately, citing health as a concern. More at arloguthrie.net and arloguthrie.org. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Arlo Guthrie, as well as to multiple members of the Guthrie family who helped to arrange this interview when he was getting ready to perform in Riverside a number of years ago. It was great to meet them and other members of the family when I saw Guthrie a few nights after this interview. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support. And again, any time of the year, you don't have to wait for the campaigns. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. Thanks again.